Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source, grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are its traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. Please get notebook, paper, and pen so you can take notes during the show. First, let's look at some debt-related news and facts for the week. An interesting article from the New York Times, A Little Judge Who Rejects Foreclosures by Michael Powell. The judge waves you into his chambers in the State Supreme Court building in Brooklyn, past the caveat taped to his wall, be sure brain in gear before engaging mouth, and into his inner office where foreclosure motions are piled high enough to form a minor alpine chain. Every week, the nation's mightiest banks come to his court seeking to take the homes of New Yorkers who cannot pay their mortgages, and nearly as often, the judge says, they file foreclosure papers speckled with errors. He plucks out one motion and leafs through. A Deutsche Bank representative signs an affidavit claiming to be the vice president of two different banks. His office was in Kansas City, Missouri, but the signature was notarized in Texas, and the bank did not even own the mortgage when it began to foreclose on the homeowner. The judge's lips pucker as if he had inhaled a pickle. He rejected this one. I'm a little guy in Brooklyn who doesn't belong to their country clubs. What can I tell you? He says, adding a shrug for punctuation. I won't accept their comedy of errors. The judge, Arthur M. Schack, 64, fashions himself a judicial Don Quixote, tilting at the phalanxes of bankers, foreclosure facilitators, and lawyers who file motions by the bail. While national debate focuses on bank bailouts and federal aid for homeowners, that has been slow in coming. The hard reckonings of the foreclosure crisis are being made in courts like this, and Justice Schack's sympathies are clear. He tossed out 46 of the 102 foreclosure motions that have come before him in the last 2 years, and his often scathing decisions, peppered with allusions to Croesus-like wealth of bank presidents, have attracted the respectful attention of judges and lawyers from Florida to Ohio to California. At recent judicial conferences in Chicago and Arizona, several panelists praised his rulings as a possible national model. His opinions, too, have been greeted by a cry of affront from a bank official or two who say this judge stands in the way of what is rightfully theirs. HSBC Bank appealed a recent ruling, saying he had set a dangerous precedent by acting as both judge and jury, throwing out cases even when homeowners had not responded to foreclosure motions. Judge Schack, like a handful of state and federal judges, has taken a magnifying glass to the mortgage industry. In the gilded haste of the past decade, bankers handed out millions of mortgages with terms good, bad, and exotically ugly, then repackaged those loans for sale to investors from Connecticut to Singapore. Sloppiness reigned. So many papers have been lost, signatures misplaced, and documents stated inaccurately that it is often not clear which bank owns the mortgage. Justice Schack's take is straightforward and sends a tremor through some bank suites. If a bank cannot prove ownership, it cannot foreclose. If you are going to take away someone's house, everything should be legal and correct, he said. I'm a strange guy. I don't want to put a family on the street unless it's legitimate. Justice Schack has small jowls and big black glasses, a thin mustache, and not so many hairs combed across his scalp. He has the impish eyes of the high school social studies teacher he once was, aware that something untoward is probably going on at the back of the classroom. He is Brooklyn-born and bred, with a master's degree in history and an office loaded with autographed baseballs and photographs of the Brooklyn Dodgers. His written decisions are a free associative trip through popular, legal, and literary culture with a sideways glance at the business pages. Confronted with a case in which Deutsche Bank and Goldman Sachs passed a defaulted mortgage back and forth and lost track of the documents, the judge made reference to the film classic It's a Wonderful Life and the evil banker played by Lionel Barrymore. Lenders should not lose sight, Justice Shack wrote in that 2007 case, that they are dealing with humanity, not with Mr. Potter's rabble and cattle. Multi-billion dollar corporations must follow the same rules in the foreclosure actions as the local banks, savings and loan associations, or credit unions, or else they have become the Mr. Potters of the 21st century. Last year, he chastised Wells Fargo for filing error-filled papers. The court, the judge wrote, reminds Wells Fargo of Cassius' advice to Brutus in Act 1, Scene 2 of William Shakespeare's Julius Caesar. The fault, dear Brutus, is not in our stars, but in ourselves. Then there is a Deutsche Bank case from 2008, the juicy part of which he reads aloud. The court wonders if the instant foreclosure action is a corporate Kansas City shuffle or a complex confidence game, he reads. In the 2006 film Lucky Number 11, Mr. Goodcat, a hitman played by Bruce Willis, explains, "A Kansas City shuffle is when everybody looks right, you go left." The bank's reaction? Justice shrugs. "They probably curse at me," he says, "but no one is interested in some little judge." Little drama attends the release of his decision. Beaten down homeowners rarely show up to contest foreclosure actions, and the judge scrutinizes the bank's papers in his chambers. But at legal conferences, judges and lawyers have wondered aloud why more judges do not hold banks to tougher standards. To the extent that judges examine these papers, they find exactly the same errors that Judge Shack does, said Catherine M. Porter, a visiting professor at the School of Law at the University of California, Berkeley, and a national expert in consumer credit law. His rulings are hardly revolutionary. It's unusual only because we so rarely hold large corporations to the rules. Banks and the cottage industry of mortgage service companies and foreclosure lawyers also pay rather close attention. A spokeswoman for One West Bank acknowledged that an official confronted with a ream of foreclosure papers had mistakenly signed for two different banks, just as the Deutsche Bank official did. Deutsche Bank, which declined to let an attorney speak on the record about any of its cases before Justice Shack, emailed a PDF of a three-page pamphlet in which it claimed little responsibility for foreclosures, even though the bank's name is affixed to tens of thousands of such motions. The bank described itself as simply a trustee for investors. Justice Shack came to his recent prominence by a circuitous path, having worked for 14 years as a public school teacher in Brooklyn. He was a union representative and once walked a picket line with his wife, Delia, who was a teacher too. All was well until the fiscal crisis of the 1970s. "Why'd I go to law school?" he said. "Thank Mayor Abe Beame, who froze teacher salaries." He was counsel for the Major League Baseball Players Association in the 1980s and the 1990s when it was on a long winning streak against team owners. "It was the millionaires versus the billionaires," he says. "After a while, I'm sitting there thinking, he's making $4 million, he's making $5 million, and I'm worth about $1.98. So he dived into a judicial race. He was elected to the Civil Court in 1998 and to the Supreme Court for Brooklyn and Staten Island in 2003. His wife is a Democratic district leader, the daughter Elaine is a lawyer, and their son Douglas a police officer. Justice Shack duels with the banks started in 2007 as foreclosures spiked sharply. He saw a plague falling on Brooklyn, particularly its working class black precincts. "Banks have given out loans structured to fail," he said. The judge burrowed into property record databases. He found banks without clear title and a giant foreclosure law firm, Stephen J. Baum, representing two sides in a dispute. He noted that Wells Fargo chief executive John Stumpf made more than $11 million in 2007, while the company's total returns fell 12%. Maybe, he advised the bank, counsel should wonder, like the court, if Mr. Stumpf was unjustly enriched at the expense of Wells Fargo stockholders. He was, how to say it, mildly appalled. I'm a guy from the streets of Brooklyn who happens to become a judge, he said. I see a bank giving a $500,000 mortgage on a building worth $300,000, and the interest rate is 20%, and I ask questions. What can I tell you? So that's a New York Times article, A Little Judge Who Rejects Foreclosures. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. So let's move on to the second section of the show. I start with an important credit, as the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in these programs are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of Professor Elizabeth Warren from Harvard and her daughter Amelia Warren Tyagi, two of America's leading champions for debtors. I highly recommend their books, All Your Worth and The Two Income Trap. Also, all of the past shows are interrelated in some very profound ways, so it would be worth your while to go to the archives at www.kruufm.com and look under Life and Debt so you can listen to past programs to get a better understanding and a foundation for the entire course, which helps with past debt, current financial problems, and putting some money together in the future to never have to deal with this kind of debt again. In the last shows for about a month, I have been talking about bankruptcies kind of as the culminating point to having debt problems. I discussed Chapter 7 and briefly Chapter 13, and I will go more into some of these issues in the future. But what I was talking about last week is if in fact you need to file a bankruptcy because it is your best option, you have to start by hiring an attorney. In theory, you can go alone or use a filing service. Going alone is called pro se. It's very risky. Filing services cannot provide legal advice, but they often charge as much as a lawyer anyway. The laws now, particularly under the new law since 2005, have quite a few unexpected traps in them, so you're much safer to hire an attorney. Even when you hire your attorney, realize that there's no magic wand associated with this kind of practice, but you should certainly look for some important ways to distinguish a good bankruptcy attorney. According to Professor Warren and her daughter, you look for a specialist. You look for somebody who is practically doing only bankruptcy work. You stay away from small outfits that advertise bankruptcy along with divorce, immigration, car accidents, and a bunch of other things, according to the professor. Instead, you look for someone who does a lot of bankruptcy work and not much of anything else. You, of course, can check the phone books. You can call your county or state bar associations. And I personally recommend you go online under the National Association of Consumer Bankruptcy Attorneys, NACBA, which has a national attorney finder, so any state that you're in can lead you to an attorney who is really a specialist in the area of bankruptcy. Once you have chosen your attorney, you will be given a whole regimen of things that you have to collect and give to the attorney and his or her office. There's a lot of preparation for filing bankruptcy, a lot of form filling out, and lots of forms. The forms will ask a lot of questions. For example, what do you own? When did you get it? How much debt do you owe? Whom did you pay? What is your income? What kind of transfers have you made? And the list goes on until you think that your attorney knows everything about you. But in good law firms, there are ways to streamline the whole process. In any event, you have to save your bills, your statements, your mortgage papers, your car security agreement, and frankly, all your other financial papers. You may need them for the forms. It may feel tedious, but the paperwork is very important. These aren't just a bunch of papers filed away where no one ever reads them. The forms are highly significant. That is the final petition and schedules. You have to sign those forms under penalty of perjury, just like testifying in court. So you want to give the law firm the complete and correct information and get all of the answers on the forms precisely and exactly right. Once it's all put together and reviewed with you and your attorney, you will be able to have the papers filed, which the attorney usually does a day or two after you finish the paperwork. In most states now, in bankruptcy court, it's done electronically through a computer. The attorney doesn't have to mail anything out to the court nor show up at the courthouse with the paperwork. Now, once that case is filed, you get immediate relief from the bankruptcy court. A court order is in effect from the moment that the case is filed electronically. That is a stay of all activity against you from creditors, including lawsuits, telephone calls, garnishments, anything of that nature. Because once the papers are filed with the court, all efforts to collect from you must stop. The attorney and the court system make sure that every creditor is notified. Of course, those are creditors that you have listed, and it's important to list everybody. And you can call your lawyer if anyone tries to hassle you after filing. Now, many cases, even a mortgage foreclosure or an auction of your house would stop. However, there are some specialized ways where a creditor can take his or her case out of the stay protection by filing a motion for relief from stay, but that really depends on a lot of circumstances, and so you have to speak to your attorney about that. Once the case is filed, you will also get a notice in the mail to appear at a meeting with the bankruptcy trustee. Now, typically, when we think of bankruptcy, there's five individual parties. There's the debtor, there is the creditors, there are two types of trustees, and there is a judge, all involved in your case. The hearing that you have to go to, the meeting you have to go to, is called a meeting of creditors, although in most cases, creditors never appear there. What happens is you have to go in front of one of the two kinds of trustees, called a standing trustee, and present your petition under oath, explain your facts, mostly through the response to typical questions that the trustee asks. This type of meeting is held generally in a hearing room, not in a courtroom, and most times not even in a courthouse. Also, there are a lot of hearings that are going to be listened to that same day, often in the same hour, so everyone is congregating there who has filed a bankruptcy, which is scheduled for that day. When your turn arrives, you go to the trustee's hearing table and you are sworn in, where you're promising to tell the truth. The entire hearing is being tape recorded, and for most people, the questions you will be asked are fairly routine. For the most part, the trustee is trying to discover if you have any non-exempt assets or you left anything out, because that would be something of interest to getting a liquidated value to non-exempt assets to pay your unsecured creditors something. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. And we've been talking about actually attending a bankruptcy meeting on a bankruptcy case that was filed. As I was saying, the hearing is under oath and it is fairly routine. But in continuing, if something unusual happens, if you left out some non-exempt asset from your petition and you remember it, or your spouse who was supposed to be there didn't show up, then, of course, your case may have to be held over for further examination. However, That is less usual. Probably about 99% of all the cases, when the questions are over, the trustee will eventually recommend that you receive a standard discharge of your debt. Depending on where you filed, the process can take anywhere between a couple of minutes to 15 minutes for the most part. After that hearing, there usually is a window of about 60 days or so where creditors or trustees, including the second trustee, which is an assistant U.S. trustee for the region, could object to something regarding your petition, your testimony, or your case, etc. But again, these are less usual than you would think. If nothing happens during that 60-day period and you had no assets to liquidate for the trustee, then generally, after that 60-day period, a discharge order is made by the judge, often whom is so out of the direct line of sight that you don't even realize there is a judge involved. And even if you had some assets that needed to be liquidated, but no objections come during that 60 days, then you would still normally get your discharge, but the case would not close quickly after that. It would remain open, and the trustee would send out a notice to creditors that they can file a proof of claim to get part of their debt paid off by the assets that are not exempt and liquidated. But even with this, for most people who have non-exempt assets, there's not a lot of personal involvement that they have at that point. It's between their lawyer and the trustee, and it generally goes rather smoothly. And once that comes to a conclusion, then of course the case is closed too. The discharge had already been entered, and any deficiency that the creditors were not paid is discharged based on the discharge order. Most people are generally amazed by how fast it all is, but it certainly can be stressful, and it is important to be associated with an attorney that you get along with and who is generally interested in reducing the stress in your life too. So that's a very important thing. Now also, if you have filed a Chapter 13 because you have some extra money left over to pay your creditors, then a plan had been filed and the discharge wouldn't have taken place after those 60 days. The plan has to be before the court and confirmed as an appropriate and acceptable plan. The trustee has to agree with that, and all of the creditors have to look at it and perhaps let it ride through, or they can and often do file objections, and a whole process takes place in dealing with the Chapter 13 to get that to a place where the court says, yes, this is what you have to pay every month. Also, Chapter 13 typically deals with arrearages that people have to pay, for example, on their mortgages or their car payments, and so it's a different process, and it has very clear and important rules on how to get those things handled. And it is based on how much money you have and can afford to pay into a trust plan. The very good thing about the Chapter 13 is it is all under court supervision, unlike debt negotiation or settlement kind of company, where there is very little power behind what they are doing. The court order in a Chapter 7 or a Chapter 13 is extraordinarily strong, and in a Chapter 13, things are completely under the court's review, at least at the beginning of the case. Again, this is something you need an expert involved in your case to make sure that the plan is correct and that you understand what you need and what you have to do, and of course what you may not be able to do or accomplish. Now, of course, too, there is a cost when you file bankruptcy. There are fees that are associated with the filing. In a Chapter 7, it's $299 now to file, the money going to the court, $274 to the court in a Chapter 13. Plus, people have to take consumer credit and debtor education courses both before the bankruptcy and after the bankruptcy, which is a ticket in and a ticket out. And those can cost anywhere between $35 and $50 to take those courses. Plus, many firms also do a credit report electronically to help prepare the petition. And then again, that could cost between $30 and $50. Now, those are just the costs that are paid to providers, and the attorney's fees vary quite a lot. And of course, a Chapter 7 is going to vary with a Chapter 13. The simplicity and complexity of the case will also have a bearing on the cost for the attorney's fees, as does the fact that since 2005, there's a lot more paperwork for attorneys to go through and a higher due diligence level for attorneys. So law firms typically have increased their costs from before 2005 to operate under the new law, and sometimes that can be substantial. Obviously, you need to shop around a little bit and make sure that you're comparing services with costs. Some law firms are full service and organize everything for you, such as the credit counseling and debtor education course, and some go to court with you, whereas some don't. They have a local attorney standing in their place to represent you. Just like everything else that I have discussed in this show, you need to make sure you know what you're getting, how much it costs, and that there are no small print issues that you don't understand. Generally, my experience is that you need to have a rapport with your attorney. It's often something that's intuitive, something you feel, and something that makes you feel less stressful and confident. So like all other purchases, don't hire a bankruptcy attorney until you feel clear on what you are going to get out of the agreement and you are comfortable with that law firm and its staff and the services offered before you sign up. Bottom line is that it does cost money to file bankruptcy, which is often hard to swallow when you already feel like you don't have any money, but the benefit can greatly outweigh the cost if it is done thoroughly and properly. Generally, you will be reducing a large amount of debt at just a tiny fraction of the amount that is going away. And it does take some savings at the beginning to get it to happen, that you have enough money to actually file your bankruptcy. And it does seem a little peculiar that in America, there are so many people saving up to go broke, but the truth is they are generally broke already and are looking for a fresh start, a new beginning, a way to deal with massive debt problems and harassment in an honorable, dignified, legal, and appropriate way. In the year 2009, we will see approximately 1.4 million consumer bankruptcy filings in America, which sounds like a huge number. But the other side of it is that as one studies all of the machinations and events that lead a person to the necessity of filing bankruptcy and compare that with those who actually do, it's only a small portion of the people who really should be filing bankruptcy that do take the step. And the reasons they need to file bankruptcy, as we've talked about a lot in this show historically, are based on conditions and events completely out of their control. It, of course, is not something that should be taken lightly, but it should be something that is considered honestly and completely when one is at the point of drowning in debt. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life in Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.